I see. Okay. Okie doke. I think so, yeah. All right. Okay. So maybe we just think first. Start think. Put a little thought into our minds. Thinking, I'm going to listen to Buddha's teachings here. See what the Buddha says about life, about the mind, about happiness, about suffering, about my potential, so that I can, you know, take away a few tools, one or two or more, that I can use in my life to help me develop my qualities and be of benefit to others. At the very least, think this much. What are all those sounds there? The funny sounds in them. Huh? Just, can you hear all those? Is it? Which is the recording? This one. So you just have to put up with the noise, you mean? Oh, that's what I mean, yeah. Sure, absolutely. Much better. Yes. So with this attitude in mind, we just listen to us, we'll have a little chat about what the Buddha says for this reason, thinking we take away a few tools so we can be to use in our life to help us move one step forward in the development of our own amazing potential so that we can be a little bit more beneficial to others, one step at a time. Just thinking like this. Okay, so what does Buddha say, and why would we want to listen to what Buddha says? What would be the purpose? Why do a person want to use Buddhism in their life? What's the reason? You know? Well, the bottom line for Buddha is that we've all got potential. We've got potential to be less neurotic and more happy. We've got potential to be, you know, less miserable and more kind. I mean, basically this. And so the reason to be a Buddhist, the reason to even be a 1% Buddhist is this. Very minimal, is to help you become a, you know, it's just using skills. Buddha gives us skills to use to become, to develop our potential. That's all, our inner potential. So what's that mean, you know? I mean, when we think about in the world, we think, who am I? What is the purpose of my life? These are the questions we all, kind of the big questions we have, you know. Why am I here? What is the purpose of my life? Who am I? I mean, in the long term, you can talk about the way Buddha talks about the very nature of what we really are. He really gets down very kind of into the nitty-gritty of this, you know, and would say that we all possess the potential to be a Buddha. So what does that mean? I mean, simply speaking, the word Buddha, it's Sanskrit, and it means fully awake. And if you were to describe the qualities of a Buddha, it would sound like, sounds a bit like God, which sort of thinks, you know, that makes us think, oh, okay, you know, Buddhism, religion, like everything else is religion, blah, blah, you know. It's true. But what's interesting about the Buddha is that you could also really say that he's speaking psychologically. He doesn't use the word soul. He doesn't use the word spirit. Not in the way we usually mean them when we think of spiritual, you know. Really, the word psychology is really more appropriate for the Buddha because he talks about the mind. That's it. That's the word he uses, the mind. But he happens to have probably, you could say it, a very, quite a radical, quite different view, more expansive view of what he means by the word mind. When we say mind, we mean that we want to start getting technical about it. We point to our brain. He would say your mind isn't your brain. So you could say that, you know, he agreed with all the other religions that say there is something non-physical about it, but he doesn't call it a soul. Like I said, he says it's the mind. But he would also say it isn't just some mysterious part of us, some special spiritual part of us. He would say the word mind includes all the thoughts, you know, intellect, or your feeling, you know, what we mean by unconscious, subconscious. All of this is what Buddha's dealing with, not just some special part of us called the soul, and he's not talking about something called your brain. He's talking about, he would say all of this, the whole spectrum of your inner experiences, this is your mind, and this is where the workshop is, as Lama Zopa Rinpoche puts it. That's where a person who is a Buddhist is learning to become very familiar, is learning to know about their mind. Because the Buddha would say our potential for happiness and the potential you know, for suffering equally, are in the mind. This is where they exist. So for Buddha, his real expertise is the mind, in fact. He doesn't just talk about it in a sort of passing way, you know, but actually his whole deal is about the mind. If you're dealing with your mind, knowing who you really are, knowing your thoughts and your feelings and your emotions, taking responsibility for them and changing them, then that's what being a Buddhist means. But he really is quite, you could almost say extreme in the importance he puts into the mind. Because actually, you know, where he differs from other religions in quite a radical way is in the sense that he would say that we're not created by anybody else. He would say this mind of ours, which is not physical, he would say, doesn't come from mummy and daddy, you know, and doesn't come from a superior being. And these are the usual two options we have, isn't it, you know? You're either created by a superior being or you're created by your mummy and daddy. If you're a materialist, you know, is the latter, and the former, if you're religious. Well, Buddha has this third option, this third approach. He would say your mind is your own and it doesn't come from anyone else. He thinks that's a bit of a nutty idea, you know? So, well, he's more polite than that. But, you know, even if you do have a view of a creator, that's okay. Buddha thinks it's okay to talk about these things. The Buddha's view, from the big picture point of view, which for a Buddhist, actually, if you really want to go very deeply into all this, plays an important role. You have this big picture. This mind of ours, the Buddha would say, which is not physical, if you think of it as like a river of mental moments, think of it as sort of all your thoughts and feelings of today coming back from all your thoughts and feelings of yesterday, coming from all your thoughts and feelings of the day before, you know perfectly well, if you had good memory, you could track it right back. You know, you track it right back to when you're a little girl, little boy, and then you keep going back and back, and of course, inevitably, you're going to get back to your mummy's womb, aren't you? And in fact, you'll get right back to the first moment of conception. So the crucial point there, of course, is if you're religious, if you're Christian or Muslim, the second before conception, you know, you were, what do we say? Sparkle in your mummy's eye. What do we say? Twinkle. We were twinkle in God's eye, but if you're a materialist, you're a twinkle in your mummy and daddy's eye, weren't you? But if you're a Buddhist, the Buddha would say you can track your consciousness back to a previous moment of itself. It's its own entity. It's its own momentum. And this is where this whole business of reincarnation comes in, which again, especially in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, where there's a strong emphasis in the big monastic universities of studying very deeply and very extensively the psychology and the philosophy and the metaphysics of the Buddha, you know. There's a big tradition of that. So, but the point here is about this idea, not just as an interesting philosophical concept, the idea that your own consciousness is yours and that it comes from previous moments of itself and you track it back before conception and you continue to track it back. The idea here is not just to sort of have this as an interesting philosophy, but it's to see the experiential implications of it. And that's the real point. And this and all that is here is reinforcing, emphasizing, you know, Buddha's approach that our mind is really our own, and that what is in it is really our own. I mean, the commonest view we have in the world, whether a Christian or not, is, you know, you're angry because someone else did something to upset you, and you're jealous because your boyfriend slept with your best friend, and you're happy because someone was kind to you. So the typical view we all have, which we never ever question, is that we are happy and we suffer because of factors outside of us. We're the product of conditions. We're subject to conditions. So in other words, we tend to sort of think a little bit like a victim. I'm happy because this happened, and I'm suffering because that happened, you know. And so in order to be happy, because we know we want to be happy, we try to get the nice things and avoid the bad things. But the Buddha would say, that's fine. But when he really talks, it comes down to the real nitty-gritty of his approach. It is that actually the main source of your happiness, your main source of your suffering is in your mind. Is in your mind. So this is a really big thing for the Buddha. You know, it's not just, like I said, a passing idea. You've got this mind and it's this and it's blah, 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 you know. But the implication of it is the real point, and this is the essence of Buddhist practice. This is why Buddhist meditation, this is why these amazing techniques in Buddhism, these amazing psychological techniques that have been around for thousands of years, well before the Buddha, you know, these meditation techniques, he even took them from the Hindus. This particularly a kind of meditation that really enables you to focus your mind, to go very deeply to a subtler, more refined level of your mind. This is a huge tool in Buddhism for a very practical reason. Given that your mind is yours, and given that the source of your happiness and your suffering is mainly within your own mind, then we need these tools to help us investigate and to know very well the contents of this mind so that we can change it. This is really what Buddhist practice is. It's a very practical, hands-on thing, you know. Learning to know your own mind, learning to know well the contents of it so that you can develop the positive parts and lessen the neurotic parts. I mean, basically that's it. That's really what you could say. All the way to perfection, all the way to Buddhahood, all the way to this long-term potential the Buddha says every being's mind possesses, every mind possesses. This potential to be perfect, basically. This potential to be fully developed in the positive qualities and completely free of the neuroses, completely free of the negative qualities. This is essentially what Buddha's saying. All of Buddha's practice comes down to this. All the techniques that one uses, all the reason you go off and study all the philosophy and do all this and all those rituals, all of it is for this purpose, finally, to help you become familiar with your mind, recognize what is there, develop the positive and lessen the neurotic. That's it, really. That's it, all the way to Buddhahood. That's the job. So given this, then, we better be clear about what this mind is, haven't we? If we really want to know what Buddha's talking about, we better know what he means by the mind. And we better learn to know how to investigate our own mind. This is the idea. Not somebody else's mind, you know? I mean, way back when we'd study things at school, now things are changing indeed. You know, the way you'd learn about the mind is you'd cut open a rabbit's brain. It's about the best we could do, isn't it? You know? We're so sort of cut off from any idea of internal subjective feelings and learning about those except via the medium of some brain. Well, then that's not the Buddhist approach. It's an internal. You know, what's the word we use? It's like I can't think of the word now. Never mind. But this is internal process, a very deeply aware internal process, not mystical, not sort of la-di-da, not sort of, you know, airy-fairy, but a very practical process that one investigates and develops that enables one to do this job of knowing well what is there and changing it. This is the point. So it's a sort of a surprise to us, I think of changing your mind, you know, or to even think that you've got sort of very practical techniques for doing this. I think we're so caught up in the beliefs, you know, in the belief system of the materialist world, that the mind is the brain, that it comes from your parents, you know, and that the external world is the main source of what happens. Because of this, we put all our emphasis in our ordinary daily life, we put all our emphasis on the outside. So, you know, we would think of depression, for example, as a function of a malfunctioning of some chemicals within our body. So we tend to think we're a victim of it, and we have to have certain tablets that, when we take them, it'll fix the imbalance, and then we'll be less depressed. We tend to think this way, you know, or we tend to think that if it is really because I had this lousy parents and this horrible husband, then I really don't have a choice but to be angry. Anger somehow, you know, is sort of the only inevitable response available to me. We have this whole way of talking in the West that I think we really do buy into, that actually, from the Buddha's point of view, is the complete talk of the victim. I mean, in fact, even as, you know, the Buddha talks about ego, the way we, and let's talk about that, right? And as one Lama Yeshe puts it, you know, we can call ego the self-pity me, the poor me, the victim me. Even the very way we suffer, in the way that Buddha's talking, it's all because we're caught up in this wrong sense of self, and this sense of being a victim of other people, a victim of somebody who made me, a victim of a mean, ugly husband, a victim of a mean, awful world, a victim of warmongers, always a victim of something out there, and somehow that implies there's not too much I can do about it unless they change. That's the feeling we have very much, I think. And then we reinforce that with our belief that our parents made us and our belief that our mind is the brain. These ideas reinforce this kind of dualistic kind of victim view. Whereas the Buddha's view is, as I'm saying, you know, that our mind is our own. We came fully programmed into this life, the Buddha would say, really. You know, this whole idea of karma is really Buddha's philosophy. It's Buddha's fundamental philosophy about the nature of the universe, about what is the universe and how there is happiness and why there is suffering and why September 11 and why this and why that. Karma is Buddha's explanation. He goes into it very extensively. And this is the law that plays out within our mind. And so due to the actions of the past, which is the word karma, it just means action. Every single thing we say, do and think is an action, Buddha would say, karma, that brings a reaction in this very mind itself. So again, this whole idea of karma, functioning within the mind, reinforces all the time this whole approach of the Buddha, that everything that goes on inside is totally is the point. And that the knowing of our own mind well, the developing of this awareness of what goes on in our mind, is absolutely central to this the development of our qualities and the lessening of our neuroses, and therefore, of course, our ability to be a benefit to others. So it's a very internal process, and it's something, like as Lama Yeshe would put it, like learning to be your own therapist. Not kidding. Sounds like a nice marketing ploy. And it is a nice marketing ploy. but it's an accurate one, very, very accurate. So all the time, Buddha comes back down to the mind, what's going on inside here, and that is the main job. The bird needs two wings, Buddha says, wisdom and compassion. So we're talking here the wisdom wing. Compassion wing is where you get out there, you put your money where your mouth is, and you be of benefit to others. But it's based upon the work you do in your own mind. You know. So what is it in our mind then? What is it within our mind that is the source of our happiness, because we all want happiness? And what is it that's within our mind that's the source of our suffering? We all don't want suffering, so we better learn to discriminate, hadn't we? What is the main cause of this, and what is the main cause of happiness, and what is the main cause of suffering? Well, a simple way of talking, you could say the components of our mind, we can say there are three headings, positive, negative, and neutral. Very simple, not complicated. Positive, negative, and neutral. Let's forget the neutral, no big deal. Let's home in on the positive states of mind and the negative states of mind. And Buddha's meaning this in a very, very practical way, you know. And it's quite quick and easy for us to actually, broadly speaking, recognize these when we say the words. We all know the words anger, jealous, depressed, anxious, you know, low self-esteem, hate, pride, and all the things that come from this, you know, killing, lying, stealing, and so on. The minute we hear these words, we understand straight away they're in your little checklist of, you know, of neurotic ones, isn't it? If you ask somebody who's on the receiving end of those things, or you check in yourself how they feel, you know straight away they're the miserable ones. Thank you very much, and I want less of these, the better. We all know this without any kind of arguing. We don't need great philosophers or God or Buddha to tell us that. Then you hear other words like love, kindness, forgiveness, generosity, patience. You know, all these words. Compassion. Straight away. You're on the receiving end, or within yourself, immediately you recognize they're the nice ones. So then, this is it. This is what Buddha's dealing with. No great, long, big, fat book with, you know, IDD this and this syndrome and new inventions every day about some kind of new weird mental illness. Buddha says the mental illnesses are called anger, jealousy, pride, attachment, blah, blah, blah. And the positive qualities are love and kindness and compassion. And he says love and kindness, compassion, and those qualities are actually innate to us, which is a very interesting point that he makes. He says that stuff is at the core of our being. That stuff is what we are at the core of our being, and that we have no choice but to develop. Why would we want to develop them? Because it's the basis of our happiness and the basis of our capacity to be of benefit to others. Just check your own experience. Not too difficult to disprove. And then the other stuff, most interestingly, are not at the core of our being, he says. And this is quite a shock, actually, because I think instinctively, intuitively almost, and that's reinforced in all our beliefs in our materialist world, anger, jealousy, pride, and all the rest, we think they are at the core of our being, but he would say they're not. And there's all sorts of reasons. There's no time here to go too deeply into it, but it certainly needs investigating for a person who wants to work with Buddhism in their lives, you know. But it's quite a tasty concept. He would say that this stuff is not at the core of our being, is not innate, and thus can be removed. This already is a very, very interesting point, because if you think about the way we think about who we are, a person, who am I, what do I consist of, what are my qualities, you know, if I were to make a list of my qualities, you know, I think you think about it, I think we have anger, we have jealousy, we have pride, a bit of depression, some love, some kindness, some generosity. We'd make a list, and we'd include all of these qualities, and we'd get equal status to them, wouldn't we? We would say we're all born like this. So there's a deep assumption there that we never question that this stuff is innate, that therefore that we do give equal status, and that somehow this is what a person is, and the best we can do is keep a fairly reasonable balance between all these things. Not be too angry, try to be, you know, reasonably loving, not be too mean, not get too depressed, keep a reasonable balance. I think that's pretty much a view that we all hold, I think, in our culture. Well, Buddha fundamentally disagrees with this, and I think it's really, really worth thinking about. Because as long as you take that as an assumption, as long as you never question that, then of course you're not going to try and change your anger. You'll try and control it. You know, but if there's no view that it is not innate to you, which is a really interesting proposition, and that's Buddha's, then why would you try to change it too much? You would not, you know. But this is the point. What Buddha's saying is that it's not innate. It does not belong. And that really does need thinking about, careful thinking about, because we can be forgiven for thinking that it is innate. I think we think it is innate. I think that we therefore think it is something that we really can't change. Like we can control it if we can do our best. But actually, the more, you know, but this idea that, you know, where we, this idea of giving equal status to the neuroses and the positive qualities is reinforced by this view that we're all born this way, that someone else makes us this way. And it's reinforced, I think, by the view that anger and all these qualities are mainly caused by outside circumstances. So if you take the Buddha's view, one, that your mind is your own and you brought it with you. Two, therefore you weren't created by anybody else, that what is in your mind is truly yours, that it is there from the habit of having done it before. Second, that the main source of your happiness is not the punch, not the kindness from Mary's mouth, and the main source of your suffering is not from Fred's punch, and that alone is quite a shock to us, and we need to look at this. I mean, let's look at it. And when, if the views we have are reinforced by these other views that we've got, then we will stay stuck in who we think we are. We'll just go around in circles. And then also, if we look at our world, we're going to see that there aren't that many real... I mean, there's not really the idea that you go off and you do a course on how to become happier. I mean, you do a course on how to become a better musician. You do a course on how to become a mathematician. But you don't do a course on how to be less neurotic and more happy. You think you go to a therapist and you unravel all your kind of painful feelings and talk about what your mummy did and you might then get a bit happier. But it seems all a bit hit and miss. It doesn't seem very doable. We don't seem to have very kind of consistent, sort of steady, graded kind of courses on this stuff. But this is in fact the Buddha's approach. This in fact is the Buddha's approach. That it's a doable thing. This development of your qualities and the lessening of neuroses is a doable step-by-step gradual process, you know, done in a very orderly way, and that there are practical methods for it. This is the point. So I think that a bit of a surprise. When we think of spiritual practice, we don't think like that. We kind of lose our common sense when we think of spiritual practice a little bit, you know, kind of a bit airy-fairy and mystical. But Buddha's very down to earth. You know, the development of these qualities within us, the development of this amazing potential, meaning simply the development of what is already inside us, the potential is there. The qualities of goodness, the qualities of kindness and compassion and empathy with others and wisdom and all the rest. This is something innate within us. And so the job is to develop this stuff, not in a hit and miss way, but in a very real, steady, gradual, doable way, such that you can develop to degrees that we would find quite shocking if we outlaid them. You know, if we outlined them, they'd sound quite outrageous to us. In other words, if you were to hear that what Buddha is saying is you can develop yourself to the point where you would have no anger left, no jealousy, no neurosis, no pride, no low self-esteem, no depression, no anxiety. That sounds almost nutty to us. We can't think of anybody like that, except if, you know, they're holy like Mother Teresa's and Dalai Lama's, and then we just think, they're born that way somehow, you know. Whereas if we can see Mozart or, you know, Lance Armstrong, we know there are methods for how to become like this. Well, that's the view here. The Buddha would say, we can become like the Dalai Lama. We can become like Mother Teresa. We can become the Buddha. The methods are to help us actually become that in this doable, practical way. And so let's look at then, in a sort of tasty way, let's look at the negative states of mind, these unhappy states of mind, the neuroses, if you like, and see in a most simple way why they are actually the main source of the pain, not the action the person did out there that triggered it. And this simple point is really quite vast and needs a lot of thinking about, because instinctively right now, we don't believe this for one second. Instinctively, we absolutely believe that I'm angry because you punched me. I am happy because you were kind to me. This is the absolute logic that we live according to now, and we never question. And you look at the world, it's the logic of the world. So let's look at this one and see if we can understand it, even intellectually, how it is so, how we are mistaken in our views, you know. So first of all, the point to get really clear is, Buddha's very straightforward in saying what is morality and what is not. And, you know, if you see the checklist of what Buddha says is, you know, non-virtuous actions, well, he's going to agree with the rest of us. No killing, no lying, no stealing, no bad-mouthing, no this, no that. Pretty straightforward, a fairly reasonable checklist of what is a non-virtuous thing to do. What is a bad action? Most of us would agree, you know. And all you've got to do is check how you feel if one of those things is done to you. Killed, lied, stolen from. We all know. So it's pretty straightforward, you know. It's pretty straightforward without getting too philosophical. You don't need to. It's experiential. And this is the interesting point. Buddha would say, you know, the way to determine what is a moral action, just check what the world thinks. Check what people like. You ask the ant. You ask the dog. You ask the human. You're going to see pretty quickly they don't like being stolen from. They don't like being kicked in the nose. They don't want to be killed if you give them the choice. Well, that's good enough reason to say don't do it. And that's the reason behind Buddha's saying that's the actions not to do. So this is an interesting point as well. Because Buddha's not a creator, he's very different in this sense. He's not a creator. He didn't invent Buddhism. He didn't make it up. He didn't speculate it. It wasn't revealed to him by somebody. So, you know, if I'm a Christian, a Catholic, let's say, I would have been taught that what is a bad action indeed is killing or lying or stealing, but it's bad because God said so. But the Buddha would say, he would agree with Jesus in saying killing, lying, stealing, they're bad actions, but he would not say it's because he says so. He's just the messenger. Your mummy tells you when you're a little girl, don't go near the fire. Well, the reason isn't because she said so. The reason is because the fire will burn you. She's just the messenger. And that's very much the role of the Buddha. So, you know, there's no concept in Buddhism of you do it because Buddha said so. It's quite different, actually. He's just the messenger. He's discovered from his own experience that if you kill, it's harmful to others and it'll harm you. This is a crucial point. So the morality in Buddhism isn't because Buddha said so. It's because he has found, you know, he says if we check it up, we will see that it's the stuff that hurts others. So a bad action is an action that harms another. Pretty straightforward. A good action is an action that helps another. It's experientially based. It's not moralistically based. It's not like somebody with a big stick telling you, you must do this, you must do this. It's practical. And I think that's a really interesting point to think about. So then, we can first establish that. We can establish quite quickly immoral actions, immoral behavior. Actions with your body and speech that harm others. So the very first level of practice as a Buddhist would be to refrain from these. We're not even discussing the mind yet. Sort of like junior school is where you learn to control your behavior. Looking into your mind, that's high school. That's where you get into the real tasty part of practice, when you really look into your mind. But the very first level of practice in Buddhism is don't harm others. Don't kill. Don't lie. Don't kill anything, not even an ant. Any living being at all, do not kill it. Do not harm. Bottom line for the Buddhas, for the Buddha is this one, do not harm. But then if we look into more deeply, we go to high school and we start to look into our mind, we're going to understand what it is behind those actions. And that's what we have to investigate. What is it in my mind that will cause me to lash out with my body or my speech to harm another? And that's where we look into the negative states of mind, the negative states of mind. So that's in relation to harming others. But the crucial point about the first stages of practice in Buddhism, you can define a negative action as one that harms another. But Buddha's concern in this initial stages is for us to investigate how it harms ourselves. How it harms ourselves. How my killing another harms me. How my being angry harms me. And this is the interesting point. And I think this is a crucial one to really get clear about. Because then it's not a question of being all moralistic, or I shouldn't get angry because it harms others. When you really get the first understanding that you shouldn't be angry because, you know what, Rabina, it'll break your heart, then we will all really, then when we come to terms with this, we'll really want to stop being angry. We will want to stop being angry. And this is the first point, a really crucial one, you know? So if we look into these negative states of mind, we can see there are two main characteristics that the Buddha can pinpoint, if you like. And this is the very first one. And this is indicated by one of the many terms in Buddhist psychology that's a synonym for the term, negative state of mind. One is this term, disturbing emotion. Disturbing emotion. Well, just check the last time you were jealous, angry, anxious, depressed. Disturbing is a very simple word. It's a very accurate word, isn't it? It's extremely disturbing for you. I don't care what the jealousy is about the person. It doesn't matter what the subject of your jealousy is. It doesn't matter the person you're angry with. Just have a look at what it causes you to feel. And I think you're going to see straight away it's an extremely disturbing emotion. And right there is Buddha's point. You know what, Rabina? The reason not to be angry, sweetheart, is because it will break your heart. Because it is suffering. It causes you misery. Look at what it does to you. And this is something you would think that would be so obvious to us. But you can look at the world, look at the behavior of the world, and we can deduce that it is absolutely not obvious to us. That it's the philosophy of the world, isn't it? when someone does something wrong, you get angry. And so we, and again, because we think we didn't ask to get born, it's not my fault, and we're all born this way, and it's anyway everybody else's fault, all of these views that we have reiterate this idea that I'm a victim and I'm allowed to be angry. I'm allowed to be angry. We think like this. You have a look at how we think. This vindictiveness that we have, if someone harms us or harms our country, we think, I am allowed to be angry. Anger is a natural response, and it is reasonable and understandable. And so we feel we are allowed to be angry. It is right that I'm angry, we will say. It's reasonable. Well, Buddha says we are completely insane. Aren't we looking? Cannot we see the most evident thing, that it's absolutely heartbreaking to be angry? And this really maybe shows us how split off we are from our own reality, from our own actual right there experience. That we are so caught up in the philosophy, I'm allowed to be angry, it is his fault, it's natural, we're all born this way, what can I do about it? You check, you look at the world, look at us. Then, you know, we feel like we're paralyzed. And then we defend our right to be this way. It's sort of like defending your right to stab yourself every day. You might have a right to stab yourself every day. You might have a right to be angry. Who cares? If it causes you suffering, why would you want to continue to do it? So it really does show how out of touch, I mean, how terribly, sadly, I mean, you know, deeply out of touch we are with what we're actually feeling. I mean, I think it's quite astonishing if we look at this. It's really quite remarkable. Because this is how we think. We're so caught up in our righteousness. We're so caught up in being right. I am right, you know. That person shouldn't have done this. It is right. The person shouldn't have done this, we say. Therefore, I'm right. I'm allowed to be angry. I mean, excuse me, you might be right. But, I mean, this is something that's it's really already quite amazing, just this point alone. And if we could just get this one alone, just this, on this earth, it would be a blissful world. Who in their right mind would want to be angry again when you realize the amount of pain that it causes you? But this shows how schizophrenic we are, as Lama Yeshe would put it. We're so not aware of what we're thinking and feeling, and we're so overwhelmed by a very strong philosophy. We don't think we are. We don't think we have a philosophy. But you look at what we're saying here, you know. We really do believe that I'm suffering because he did this. We really believe that, which tells us it's got nothing to do with me. I didn't ask to get born. It's not my fault. What can I do? I'm just responding naturally, you know. We actually think this is the truth. Buddha would say, you're insane. He says that's a symptom of a mental illness, thinking like this. So it really needs looking at. Because all Buddha's saying is, of course you're right. Of course you're correct to say it is wrong that someone just, you know, punched you in the nose. Of course, you check your Buddha's little checklist of bad actions. Do not punch. Do not kill. Do not harm. There it is. He agrees with you. It is not appropriate. Fred should not have punched you. He agrees. Then you're right. Then now you see what will make you happy. Now you look at what you can do to avoid any more suffering. Bad enough you've got blood coming out your nose. Why be angry as well? I mean, what a stupid choice, you know. So as long as we really believe these views that I didn't ask to get born, it's not my fault, it's all my brain anyway, and anyway it's everybody else's fault, then we will just continue to be these victims, pulled from pillar to post, you know, getting depressed when something goes wrong and happy and excited when something goes good and then jealous when something else goes wrong and angry this way and depressed that way. This is how we are now. We're complete victims of our own philosophy, actually, of our own, what Buddha would say, of our own misconceptions, of our own mistaken way of understanding how things work. So the simple point here is, all Buddha's saying is, you know what, Rabina, if you check the feeling, you check what it makes you feel, that anger, that jealousy, that anxiety, if you really can see how it causes you pain, and we're not talking about how Fred punching you causes you pain, we're talking about your angry response to Fred punching you. The Fred's punch is Fred. That's his business. The rest of it's yours. The anger is yours. The anger is yours. And this is, again, sounds simple. It sounds simple to discriminate like this so easily. Well, that's Fred, now there's me. Let's see what I can do with mine. But this is the hard part, because we are so kind of confused in our mind. We don't think the anger is ours. We really do believe it like came along with Fred's punch, like as if he injected anger at the same time as the, you know, punching the nose. We don't really even think the anger is ours. We're so caught up in the words, Fred this, Fred that. Why are you angry, Rabina? Fred this, Fred that. No, no, Rabina, that's Fred. Why are you angry? We don't even know what it means. We can't even articulate it. We can't even really see it clearly. We can't separate it from the action. And just the same way with happiness. Oh, why are you happy, Rabina? Oh, wow, you know, Fred loves me. Fred was so kind to me. We can't separate Fred's action from our feeling. And this is already, sounds simple, but quite profound, actually. Needs a lot of inner clarity, a lot of repeated work on our own mind to distinguish our part, our bit, you know, our bit. What's my bit? Really, really tough. We know all these words. This is very current in psychology around in the world these days. But this is directly coming from Buddha. This stuff is completely Buddha, you know. So all the more reason in Buddhism, as a starting point, but as a technique that one uses throughout one's life, all the way to enlightenment, is this type of meditation technique where you learn to simply concentrate your mind. You learn to concentrate. Its long-term goal is a very refined level of concentration, way more subtle than we would ever even posit as existing or even possible in our view of what the mind can do in the West. But you know this. But the immediate we might not get concentration in the long term, but the immediate benefit. An immediate benefit from doing a simple kind of concentration meditation where you just learn to focus on your boring old breath, you know, for a few minutes. The immediate benefit is that you're staying with yourself. If you think about it, from the second we wake up in the morning until the second we go to sleep, what are we doing? We're totally engaged, aren't we, in the outside world. That's where life is as far as we're concerned. We feel like this kind of schizophrenic observer. Life is out there to be had somehow, isn't it? So we're this little person plonking through life. We're totally aware only of what's out there, all the things out there, constantly judging, analyzing, assessing, grasping at, pushing away, out there. That's where our awareness is the whole time. No wonder we're all insane. We've never spent any time, and it's not part of our education, to be aware of what's going on inside here. That's why it's a brand new idea to us. It's my anger, it's Fred's punch. Oh, really? You know? But. So this starting point, as I said, but something one would use as a tool throughout one's life, is this learning this skill to focus your mind. And an immediate benefit is that you're going to be noticing what's happening in here, not just out there, in here, labeling it accurately, observing the pain it's causing, or observing whatever it is, and learning slowly, slowly, tentatively, slowly, nervously to trust that we have the capacity to change it. That we have capacity to think differently, basically. Like Mr. Apple says, think differently. And it's sort of simple words, but it's a massive job. I mean, the consequence of anyone doing this even in a halfway method is already you would be a pretty stunning person. You'd be a pretty amazing person, pretty stable. So like right now, because all of our energy is focused on the outside, is on other people and craving for this and aversion for that and jealousy about this and depressed about that, all this outside stuff, we're like this complete victim of external world, aren't we? We're going from pillar to post, or like a little puppet on a string. So we go up and down 1,000 times a day. Up and down, according to the circumstances. Whereas this way, slowly, slowly, this is the point that Buddha's emphasizing, with more and more awareness of what's going on inside here, based upon the thinking about the very nature of your mind is and how it is yours and doesn't come from someone else and the positive ones and the negative ones and beginning to recognize them. What this brings is a deep kind of stability, you know, a deep stability, an ability to keep yourself grounded and focused in the face of who knows what coming to you in this life. Where you end up being like someone like the Dalai Lama. If you look at him as a really good example of a person who's had a crazy life with intense suffering and somehow is able to always keep a sense of humor and always keep focused and always see see things from the broad perspective and keep stable, keep steady. It's not just some accident he's this way. Because he's the proof of the pudding of this kind of work we're discussing here. He's an example. A person who, regardless of what happens, can stay steady, can stay focused, can stay kind, can stay compassionate and wise and see things from the various perspectives without going crazy, you know, This is all the Buddha's saying. This is what he says we have the capability to do. This is our potential. We can learn to know our own mind deeply, and we can learn to be the boss. We can learn to run our life. We can learn to run the show, not be a victim of external circumstances, you know. This is really what Buddha's saying. And to degrees that we wouldn't even conceive of as possible. Buddha's saying we've got this phenomenal potential, extraordinary potential, and the way to do it is what we're talking about here. Learning to know your own mind and learning to unravel it and therefore change it. This is it, you know. I mean, the words are not complicated. It's just that it is the most difficult job we'll ever do. There is no doubt about it. Because we're deeply invested in the status quo right now. We've got a lot of investment in believing it's his fault and her fault. And it's as scary as hell to change that. It's very, very painful. It's terrifying. But the more we think about it, the more we can see the reasonableness of it and the logic of it, the more we will have the conviction and the courage to do the job. You know? So that's why in Buddhism it's got nothing to do with believing in something. It's just lazy, intellectually lazy. Who cares you believe in it? I'm not interested in believing in it. It's a question of seeing the logic of it and then having confidence in it. And that's why we live our lives, you know. So that's a very broad stroke. So maybe you can ask me some questions now. We can go in different directions. Or go more deeply into one or more of these pieces if you like. Yeah? Yeah.
Confuse about the mind when we talk about the mind.
Sure.
And my confusion is the following. There are 6 billion human beings.
Right.
Are there 6 billion minds, or is it one mind that we all tap into?
I think, no, the Buddha would say it's just 6 billion, you know. There's you. I mean, in a very uncomplicated way, there's you sitting there with all your own history and your experiences and your hate and your love and your anger and your depression and your music and your maths. And you can see that what you do, what you're capable of doing today is the basis of what you did yesterday. And you can see that if you practice piano, I don't get the result. If you get angry with your, you know, with Fred down the road, I don't get the punch. So it's sort of in a very obvious and immediate way, without being cosmic about it, there are 6 billion minds. There's your mind and there's my mind.
So where am I getting this concept of mind as something like the what is it, the alya consciousness, where you can tap into other beings?
I mean, there's all kinds of views in these different philosophies and psychologies and the religions around the world. There's all sorts of views, aren't there? And it's interesting to study them all. Of course it is. You know, so you can say that in Buddhist view, on the one side, here we all are, you with your delusions and your neuroses and me with mine, and we're all plodding along in our own little path, you know, learning our music and our maths and our anger and our jealousy. But at the same time, you can say that when you've fully developed your mind, when you've become this Buddha, the Buddha would say, is it the potential for you is innate, when you've fully removed all the neuroses from you and your consciousness is now pure and clear and wise and sees things as they are and is empathetic with other beings and so on and so forth, then you could argue that your mind is the same. If I've achieved that too, then we're the same one. You could argue that we all become the same Buddha, if you like. But on the simple conventional sense, as many beings as there are is as many minds as there are. Do you see? Sort of like when you know all the music and I know all the music, you could sort of argue we have the same music awareness, you know? Yeah. You understand my point?
Yeah.
Same wisdom. Yeah. You can argue then there's one if you like, but there's no need to get sort of, no big deal. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks.
Yes. Pass to the mic.
I read an article today, and it was it made me think of karma, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that. It was about this child who was in Sierra Leone, and he was recruited as a young boy for this militia. Mm-hmm. And so they fed them this stuff called brown that was cocaine, and they trained them to be soldiers, and they gave them guns, and they had them slit the throats of their enemies, and they just kept them in this frenzy all the time, made them watch Rambo all the time and everything. And then UNICEF came into this country and took some of the children who were young warriors out and brought them to New York, where they were befriended, and they were everything. Well, now this kid wrote a memoir. He's 26, and it's on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's about his complete change into a healing individual who's going around to juvenile hall to tell young kids, look, if I can change, so can you. But his karma in this lifetime, maybe you could talk about our, how we can do things that can change ourselves.
Well, you know, just give a bit of a background to karma then, just as a context for this discussion. As I'm saying here already, what Buddha's saying is, what Buddha is asserting is that, you know, his consciousness, your consciousness, her consciousness, my consciousness, these individual, you know, rivers of mental moments that are literally will be are beginningless. And this gets us a bit confused sometimes, but because we always think there has to be a beginning to everything. Well, there's a relative beginning of this person. Rabina began in her mother's womb. And there's a relative beginning of this universe. But even as this unit, even... But as the Dalai Lama said one time, Big Bang, no problem, he said. It's not the first Big Bang, that's all. So there's not, the, you know, there's not one big, in Buddhist view in general, there's not this concept of a creator who then makes everything. And there's not just Big Bang before which there was nothing. But never mind that, just the idea of your consciousness being this kind of cause and effect kind of river of mental moments, you know, that goes back and back and back. So then there's this person, this born what, Sierra Leone? Okay, so then we can say, you know, there he is, due to some virtue in the past, born as a human being. Because Buddha would say to get any kind of human life is like winning the lottery. Enormous amount of morality that ripened at the time of the past death, not many weeks before he entered his mother's womb. This is how the Buddha would say, roughly. And that morality ripened and caused him to get that human life. But then, you know, Mother Teresa's got one of those, and so has Hitler. But so what are the differences? This comes to the second way that our karma ripens, the actions we do in the past. Everything we do with our body, speech, and mind is a karma, an action that leaves an imprint or a seed in the mind that necessarily ripens in that mind in the future as its experiences. So in this sense, Buddha's saying we're the creators of our own experiences. So for this person, you could say he created the, you know, morality ripened and got him a human life, but then the second way that his karma ripened was in terms of his tendencies, our own personalities. So we can see the difference between Hitler and Mother Teresa there, can't we? You know, Hitler displayed by his act in that life pretty heavy-duty tendencies, wouldn't you agree? And Mother Teresa displayed by her actions some pretty interesting, nice tendencies. So we can say with this boy, he had a mixture of things, you know. That there he was. And so due to the third way that karma ripened, though, that's in the way that you're treated by others. He got born into that crazy country at that particular time where he was put into the militia and taught those terrible things. But those, that was also due to his karma. Everything that occurred to him, good and bad, are all due to imprints in his own mind. Like a big garden full of many flowers and many weeds that are all ripening. All the things that ripened in that garden are from seeds that you were planted in that garden in the past. So in that life, he got a human life, which is a result of virtue. He had a bunch of negative tendencies, which caused him to get born into that particular environment that then ripened as he's doing all these actions, and he did indeed do them, right? But at the same time, a certain other conditions then ripened and he was taken away, UNICEF got him, and then he had other qualities in his mind, which he's now displaying, isn't it? Now, we've got many, many stories. We work with people in prison. Same thing. Guys who spent their lives, these young Mexicans, you know, shooting and raping since they're tiny boys, you know, harming many, many beings who now are these extraordinary practitioners. So you've got a mixture. We can see in our own lives. We've got a mixture of tendencies, haven't we? Some of us lie, some of us steal, some of us are kind. You know, we've got a mixture of positive and negative tendencies. Wouldn't we all agree? We look into our minds, we can see this. But we can also see with some of us, you know, some people, let's say, have so, the negativity is so strong that even if they're confronted with the positivity, they can't find the capacity within them, at least then, to change. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I can think of many people I know, for example, who might have given up being heroin addicts, who found within them the resources to change. But there are some other people that you can think of who never, no matter how much they hear about it and try, they keep falling back because they can't find those resources within themselves. So Buddha would say we've all got the potential, but at different times you can't access it because maybe the weeds are so strong, they're strangling the flowers within your mind, if you like. It's a simple way to put it. So that he's a particular example of a person who had the negative tendencies, but then was confronted with the option, and he was, because he had the positive ones there, it triggered those, and he was able to grow those. But somebody else, one of the boys he probably trained with, he probably was still sitting there doing it because he didn't have the karma to meet a good person who would tell him the options and therefore couldn't access those parts of himself. Do you see what I'm saying?
But we have the resources. Well,
what's this we you're talking about?
I mean,
depends. Some people have and some people haven't. Okay, in the long term, what Buddha's saying, again, remember his fundamental point, which really does need thinking about, not as just a religious idea, but as a very practical thing, that the Buddha would say that the virtuous qualities are innate to all of us. They are not even just innate. They actually are the core, at the core of our being. They're indestructible. You can't remove them ever. Whereas the negative tendencies are not at the core of our being, and no matter how heavy they are and how strongly we express them and how easy it is to follow them and look at our own tendencies, how hard it is to change, they fundamentally are not at the core of our being. And that needs a lot of thinking and looking at and to see it, to see the logic of it. But that's something fundamental. So Hitler, whoever, fundamentally has the potential to be perfect, just like every one of us. But depending on the time and place where you're born and the situation and what karma you've ripened, it might not be very evident. You know, you tell a lion that that buffalo doesn't like having its guts ripped out for breakfast, he won't be able to hear you right now. As a lion, it's impossible for her to change. But she's got this fundamental Buddha nature that another time will express itself in the form of the human. You see the point I'm making? And we can see ourselves at different times. I mean, a certain time in my life, you tell me that anger wasn't good, I wouldn't like to say to you, I'm just not going to listen to you. But in later on in time, when I heard the Buddha's teaching and I heard it, I was ready to hear it. You see my point? We also can see that our minds are ready at different times to hear different things. So the crucial point is, do we have that tendency available to us? And that's the miracle. If we do, we are very fortunate. So that man is an example of that. He was very, very fortunate that due to his own past karma too, he met people who took care of him and who showed him the options, and that enabled him to ripen those tendencies within himself. And he was able to grow them. And that's fantastic. Does that make sense? Someone else? Sure, why not? Absolutely. Good attitude.
Okay, so speaking of all these negative tendencies, I wrote down here, what did I say? Oh, that there's, it's like a neurotic enjoyment, you might say, of going into spaces of anger or jealousy
true,
or something.
It? Yeah.
It's kind of like we just
run like a magnet.
This really insane space I am so jealous and I love it.
That's right. I know.
And it's like you're just into dum-dum land.
It's true, isn't it?
You know?
Yep.
And I'm watching this
I know.
Happen.
In amazement. That's right.
It's amazing. Mm. I said, that's right. God, just, you know, stop it.
Right. That's true. No, it's so, so true. But I think the only explanation for this is that it's so habitual. We can all see that the thing that we've done that often is the thing, you've dug that groove in your mind, you just go to it, you know. And the other part of your mind is looking on in amazement even as you continue to do it. It's true. Well, that's the way they talk, that's what they'd say about karma, but using simple words, that's just what habit is. The more habitual something is, even though another part of us can see it's nuts, we run like a magnet. That's right, precisely. That's the one. That's exactly right. No, that's the one. And that's, again, the miracle. Whereas let's say another person who was in Sierra Leone with this other boy, let's say he was so strongly in the negative groove that when he heard that it was not good to kill people, he would have just, you know, said, don't be so ridiculous. He could not access those other parts of himself. So at least we can rejoice that we've got those other parts and we can even hear them. Because, I mean, basically we think, I am watching, we get too caught up in that. It's just basically there's a whole bunch of tendencies in our mind. And we are so fortunate that we can even hear the positive tendencies arguing with these big, mighty, you know, Arnie-sized negative tendencies. You understand? But at least we have the miracle of being able to even notice. That's what is so special. And then with courage, we can grow those other little baby voices so that they become the strong ones. That's all the practice is, isn't it? That's all it is. I think any techniques you can use, you can personify these different parts of yourself, any way that you can learn to open ourselves up and look at the different parts. I mean, all sorts of very skillful techniques we can use to do this. Nothing wrong. Whatever helps us see our minds, then fantastic. Anything. Nothing wrong. Whatever works to help us break ourselves into these pieces and get to sort of start to grow the positive parts and give some courage to them. Anything at all. Fantastic. See what I mean? I mean, I agree. Totally. Go for it. Whatever works. Absolutely. I mean, the Buddhist approach is very much we have this mistaken idea of this massive sense of a very concrete I-ness. I am this and I am that. And usually if you look at this very concrete sense of I, it's in terms of the negativities. I'm no good, I'm hopeless, I'm bad, or an arrogance. Oh, I'm so special. It's like we're kind of inflating or deflating the reality. We don't just see reality for what it is, and that's the irony of ego. Ego is either I'm more than I think I am or I'm less than I think I am, and we go swinging madly between these two ideas. And they're utterly inaccurate, you know. Because the I is a mixture of lots of different voices. So any way that we can break down that I into its component parts, that's very healthy. It's very useful. And stop identifying with one lot or the other. Okay, you could say, if anything, we've got to start identifying with the positive. But not in an arrogant sense, like, oh, I'm so special. That's kind of inflating. And that's the thing, the irony, this is the point about ego, it either inflates or it deflates. So look in the mirror and you say, oh, I'm so beautiful. Or you look in the mirror and you say, oh, I'm so ugly. They're both really flip sides of the same coin, actually. And that's the way ego works, in an unrealistic, kind of concrete sense. So if we can, any way we can break down, so the Buddhist approach to what you're saying, is you take the different pieces and you observe the pieces. You know, you look at the jealousy and you think, yes, that is disgusting. You're not being self-hateful. We say, oh, I am disgusting because I'm jealous. No, your jealousy is disgusting. Look at it, it's like a sewer. You're fine. Don't say you're disgusting, nothing wrong. You understand? Like your ugly old filthy fingernails are dirty. Well, clean them up, please. But the rest of you is fine, you know. But we exaggerate. We're angry. Oh, I'm so bad, we'll say. It's too extreme. It's not accurate. It's just not accurate. We've got to be very accurate. See the rubbish for what it is, but really, crucially, see the good. We love to see the rubbish. If every one of us here said all our qualities, we'd all say the negative ones. Then we'd squirm and be embarrassed if we had to say the positive ones. Because ego loves, it loves negativity. Ego loves the misery. Ego loves misery. That's the irony of ego. That's the nature of ego. It's caught up in the negative. It's caught up in overemphasizing and concretizing. That's its nature. Just attachment. That's all it is. Yeah, it's insane. That's right. It's self-conscious. When there's ego less, it's unself-conscious. You're just naturally in touch with things, naturally harmonious. When the positive qualities are more prevalent, and we can all see this from our own life, we're more naturally in an unself-conscious sense of being harmonious. But as soon as the negative ones arise, it's like a vivid sense of me and a vivid sense of you over there, and we're all sort of separate, you know. But the virtuous qualities are kind of unself-conscious and natural. The negative ones are all kind of crooked and jagged and like this. You know? And they're the ones that we believe in so strongly.
You're saying, and I believe, that the good qualities are innate,
yeah.
And the negative qualities are due to karma.
No, they're all due to karma. They're all due to karma, practice.
They're all
but the negative ones are not innate. We can remove them. And there's very simple, yes, logical reasons for this.
But my question is,
yes.
How did they get started, the negative qualities get started,
right,
in the first place?
Why do you think there was a first place? Why would they, why should
karma,
there be? No, that's
but
right.
At some point in time.
No, yeah.
The negative qualities seem to be.
No, not possible. If something exists at this moment, whatever it might be, you cannot find a first moment of it. That's why I'm not the first Big Bang. You just can't. This is something very interesting to look at. We have this deep assumption that something has to have started, either me or the universe or something. But it's not so. Buddha would say, there's a fundamental physical energy. They talk in one of the ways of describing in Buddhist kind of metaphysics, whatever, that you can divide up the universe into earth, air, fire, and water. So this, you know, you can break it right down. Like at the beginning of the universe was just this subtle wind energy of the four. Well, that's beginningless. Why should it begin somewhere? It's beginningless. Why do we want it to begin? And the same with your consciousness, your mind, your river of mental moments, Regina's river of mental moments, and whatever's in it right now, it can't have a first moment. But if it did have a first moment, that implies it came into existence without depending upon a cause. And so that's what it can be. It can't be a first. Impossible. Buddha says it's a contradiction in terms. Because emotionally it seems insane.
There's some stuff I have to think. I can't,
that's right.
About there.
Exactly.
I can't formulate my.
No, I understand there, exactly. I understand. Okay, why? Very simple answer. Because you did it before. Just if you track it back. So just track it back. Okay, there's an egg there. Just on a conventional sense, you have an egg. You know it came from a chicken. If there's a chicken, You know it came from an egg. It's like this, and it's not a trick. You know, we think it's a trick. But the Buddhist view is that your mind, think of it as a continual, just like a river of mental moments. How can you find a first? Because if you know that whatever's here now is there, what's the main cause of it? The previous moment. So in other words, why are you angry? Well, honey, because you were angry before. And why were you angry then? Well, sweetie, because you were angry before. And you go back a million years. Well, why was I angry then? Well, because you were angry before. Oh, gosh, why was I angry then? Because you were angry before. You can't find the first before. That's all. But the point is, what is interesting is why we want there to be a first one. That's what is fascinating. Why we want there to be a first one. I think that's what's totally fascinating. Buddha would say it's just a wrong question. Why do you want a first moment? Why? It's kind of fascinating. Why do we want a first moment? It's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's nutty. This other one is saying your mind is beginningless is absurd. You know, we can't even remember most of this life. We can't even remember most of today. Excuse me. Forget about infinite past lives. Sounds like a complete joke, you know. Someone else. Grandiose. Well, that's what there you go. I think it's a very good point, Judith. So you know what? We call it God. So we think being beginningless is something special, so we call it God. The Buddha would say it's nothing special. It's just the nature of how everything is. Matter and mind. Matter and mind are beginningless. They don't need creating. Buddha would say we've created the creator. We've made it grandiose. It's a very good point you just made. We think of it as something special, therefore beyond. So we reify it. Buddha would say beginninglessness is just the nature of how things are. Cause and effect. Cause and effect implies beginningless. It's interesting. That's a good point, actually. Someone else? Yes, Don.
It's going to be hard for me to formulate exactly the question.
In my own struggles
with the practice of importance and non-importance,
yeah,
the ego's target to win. I got recently kind of confused about some reading that I was doing, so I kind of wanted to go back to your mm-hmm. statement a moment ago, which is about the observation of I and not I, yeah. I yeah. and yeah. the rubbish,
yeah.
and the delusion that yeah. the rubbish is actually important and real. Mm-hmm. And in some of Pema Trojan's conversation mm-hmm. about compassion, which is nonviolent position, mm-hmm. she talks about her practice, her sangha, and therein she is, in 30 days, she is learning an instrument, and at the end of 30 days is her chance to perform for one of the Dalai Lamas that comes to visit. And she is noticing over the 30 days that no one's telling her that you're doing a good job, you're doing a bad job, you're coming along. She gets absolutely no feedback. And she starts to become acutely aware of her own neurosis. And she says in her discussions about compassion that it is that you're not trading yourself, the product that you think you are, for something else. It's not like you're going to create a new product. Mm-hmm. And so compassion towards the self, the nonviolent position towards the self, is to befriend oneself with all of one's neurosis and your awareness of that.
Yeah.
And so she even says mm-hmm. at the end of her practice mm-hmm. At that sangha, she realizes that your neurosis is your wealth. Mm-hmm. So then I get kind of confused.
I understand.
It's
sure.
as we're working
yep.
with our mind,
exactly.
it can become very easy to exactly. take a mm-hmm. rejection approach.
That's right.
So
no, I think, yeah, okay. The irony now of ego is that we do hate ourselves. That's the interesting point. My mother used to say to me all the time, you're your own worst enemy. And that is the irony of ego, the way Buddha talks about ego. Ego is caught up in the neuroses. Ego's voices are anger, jealousy, depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, arrogance, and all the rest. Ego's voices are not love and kindness. They are They are not to do with ego in the sense that we're talking here, okay? So we've got these neurotic parts of us. Now, we all know they're painful. As much as whether you embrace your jealousy in the way we're describing, and I know exactly what she's talking about, and we'll discuss it, or whether you beat yourself up for being jealous, the jealousy itself is painful. Everyone, I think, can agree the very nature of jealousy is it's painful. So the point is this. Bad enough being jealous, but what we do is we then beat ourselves for being jealous. And that's the thing that she's talking about that we shouldn't be doing. What we've got to do is embrace me with my jealousy. Then I can see the jealousy quite easily and see how painful it is and happily want to get rid of it. But the other one, beating it up, just reinforces you and makes you go deeper into it and stuck in it. So it's a skillful attitude. It's like if you're learning to try and play piano. And you're always beating yourself up every time you make a mistake. You curse yourself and you swear and you hit the piano. You understand? I don't think you're ever going to progress very well. So if you start welcoming yourself as a piano player, identifying yourself as a good piano player, you're going to be happy to see the things you're doing wrong. And they will be simple practical facts of right and wrong in what is preventing you from being a better piano player. But you will welcome it and you won't be mean to yourself for it. Then you'll change all the more. So when you can welcome, that's the difference. Then you can happily see there are parts of you that do cause you pain. In other words, it's bad enough being angry. Why beat yourself up as well? That is just guilt. It's like blame. It's totally impotent and it doesn't help. Whereas if you, or another way to say it is, you're seeing your potential musician. Every day you identify with that amazing potential musician. So then you're delighted to find the things you're doing wrong because that's holding you back from becoming this marvelous musician that you really are. So it's a kindness to yourself. That you're seeing this is rubbish and I want to get rid of it. But just being hopeless and I'm bad and I'm no musician, I'm no good and I can't play the piano, kick, kick, you won't ever go past grade one. You see my point? Yeah. And actually it's harder because we love to be feeling guilty. We love to blame. We love to, and that's the one that we're all the time doing now, and that's our big cop-out. And we think there's a virtue in pointing out our negativities all the time. But in the way we do it, there's no virtue at all. It's not taking responsibility. This other way identifies with your potential, which is a kindness, which is a compassion to yourself, and then sees the things that are holding you back. Another attitude, again, you open up the hood of your car. Your car doesn't work, let's say, but you know it's a good car. You know it's got potential. So when you open up the hood, what are you looking for? What are you looking for? The problem. So when you find the problem, how do you respond? What do you say? When you find the problem, what do you say?
Say, aha, now I can fix it.
Great. Now I can fix it. That's the point. That's the one. The other one is, oh my God, this car doesn't work. Kick, kick. And now I found another problem. Kick. Now the brakes don't work. Kick. That's what we do now. We're useless. You see my point. This other one is seeing the potential, which is compassion, and then seeing the things that are holding it back. And then you cheer when you find them because now you can fix them. It's a very, very different attitude. It's an attitude of love and compassion. Definitely. And when you can do that for yourself, you can do it to others. You see, because it's taking responsibility. Guilt is not taking responsibility. It sounds virtuous, but it's ego's voice. Just, it's self-obsessed. You understand?
Well, you've just been talking about guilt, and I remember having heard you say some things about guilt before, and I just would like to hear them again, because guilt is so prevalent in our society, yeah. And it is so dysfunctional, and I just would love to have you just talk, expand that a little bit, why it is so dysfunctional, you know, how does it keep us from developing our potential?
I think here, you know, if we can begin to hear the nature of the different voices within us, and so we can categorize the two main kinds of voices, the positive voices and the negative voices. If we can begin to hear the character of the negative voices, then we can see the suffering, whether it's guilt or anger. It doesn't matter what it is you're pointing to. The character of the negative voices is panic and fear and small and not taking responsibility, and schizophrenic, and incapable, and hopeless, panic and fear. The voices of the positive are hopeful, and harmonious, and connected, and constructive, and brave. I mean, that's what I'm just talking very generally. When you say, I can do something, when you can learn from a mistake and say, I can do it, and you go and you do the thing to change, that's it's painful, but you've got courage and you see you can do it. Guilt doesn't think that. Guilt just likes to find the fault. Partly we think there's some virtue in it, like there's pleasure in the neurosis, you know. Partly, but it's sort of like holding back. And it's nature, it's panic and fear. It's nature. All the negative voices, they're hopeless and panic-stricken and stuck and fearful. And that, if you look behind anger, behind jealousy, behind any of the unhappy states of mind, low self-esteem or arrogance, I don't care which, that's the same. Whereas when it's, even if it's painful in the changing, the fact that you're engaging in it and doing it, there the courage is. That's when it's hopeful. You're doing something. You're moving forward. There's something beneficial there. There's something kind of also humble. Guilt is like blame, except you're the object of it instead of someone else. There's no difference. You blame someone else or you blame yourself, either one, and we love to blame ourselves. But if you blame yourself, you also blame others. You know, and if you don't like yourself, it means you don't like others either. And so it's in general the voice behind the unhappy ones is fear and panic and paralyzed. No action, not action. Anger. I mean, interesting, recently I heard Martin Luther King say something like, nothing wrong with anger, but do something about it. And I think that's a very good way to see, in one way of talking, in Buddhist psychology, the more advanced level is like Tantra, they talk in Tantra, where you can actually utilize the poison as medicine. And so if you look at the negativity of anger, it's the hopelessness and fear and panic of when you meet something that you don't like, then it's just freak out, isn't it? It's freak out. So you shout and kick and yell and scream and curse and swear. But if you can see that and use that as a positive thing, you see there's a problem, then you say, what can I do about it? So the difference between the car, open up the hood and you see the problem, you kick and swear, or you say, what can I do about it? Then it's good to find mistakes. It's good to find problems. But now you say, let me see what I can do about it. So guilt, regret and guilt. We have a practice we do every day. We call it the purification practice in the end of the day, right? And His Holiness the Dalai Lama was asked, what's the difference? This first step we have, we call it regret. And you can define that in many ways, but we define it a particular way here. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama was asked, what's the difference between that and guilt? And it was very sweet. He said, guilt is looking into the past and saying, I did this, I did this, I did this, and I'm a bad person. And so you keep repeating it. You just keep saying, I'm a bad person, like as if it's virtuous. But you do nothing about it. You're just stuck in it. Regret is saying, in the past I did this and I did this, and then you say, and what can I do about it? That's the part. So the positive qualities are hopeful. They are confident. They're brave. They act, and they're active. The negative ones are impotent in their nature. Jealousy, anger. You look at any of them, they're impotent. They're paralyzed. They're utterly frozen in space, and that's the terror of them. The positive ones, you recognize the problem, but you say, what can I do about it? So even the wisdom in us can see the jealousy, can see the hurt, can see the neurosis, can see the guilt. But the positive part of us can say, now let's see how I can change it. Because that's not the real me. It's just, it's like a bit of dirty stuff on my arm. I can change it. It's okay. It doesn't define me. And that's a positive take on it. And even that then will loosen it. So the key one, I think, is to really to identify, Buddha has all these kind of philosophical ways of describing the negative qualities. But this is an experiential way of talking about how they feel. You see? In other words, we are full of shit. Excuse me. We are angry. We are jealous. We are neurotic. We are miserable. But hey, it doesn't define you and you can change. Great! Rather than, we're full of shit, beat, beat, beat. Fundamentalist position. That's the trouble with religion. We either, or religion or whatever, we either become completely fundamentalist and we think there's a virtue in saying we're all sinners and we just beat ourselves up and get terrified and fundamentalist, or we become completely hedonistic and greedy, bottomless pit, just grasping and stuffing ourselves with, and both ways it's just we miss the boat somewhere, So we've got to see the problems, but rejoice about them, we've seen them, and identify with the potential, beautiful, marvellous racing car, Not just, oh my God, this car's a disaster. There is garbage there. But hey, I can change it. It doesn't define me. And that means you've got to see your positive qualities. And that means we must say them. So they have this, they use the word in Tibetan, rejoice. We've got to rejoice. It sounds so boring, rejoice. It sounds so holy. It sounds like religion, But it's very, very powerful. It means, how about finding some good qualities? I did make an effort. I am doing well. I did try my best. I am not in a defensive little poor girl way. Like, it's not fair. I did my best, you understand? But in a genuine, positive, a really positive way, looking at the progress you've made. We love to always see the progress we don't make. We're always seeing the faults. That's the way the negative one talks. But if we are seeing our good qualities and seeing our marvelous potential, then we're delighted to see the faults and they don't have so much power for us. That's when it's good to see. And then it's very simple. Then it's not so complicated. You know. You know, there's this New Age saying, isn't there, that it's either fear or love. I think it's profoundly true. They talk in Buddhism, they use the term samsara. And all samsara means in a simple way is being caught up in the neuroses. Locked into these neuroses, we're in samsara, quote unquote. When you're in nirvana, quote unquote, you're out of the neuroses. You've cut them, you know. So it's psychologically speaking. So they talk about the fears of samsara. The fears of samsara. Fear is at the basis. The more we see our minds, the more we see these neurotic and hear these neurotic voices, they are just rampant with fear. And the nature of the positive ones is not fearful. They're courageous and open and harmonious and connected. The others are just locked and paralyzed and bereft and lonely and fearful. You know. That's the nature of the neurotic eye. It's interesting, isn't it? What else, people? You can talk more about karma or whatever you like. Where are we? Nobody. Yes, Colin.
Yeah, I'll probably have a little trouble getting trying to put this together.
Don't worry, doll.
I get a little stuck here with something around, you know, groups of people who are oppressed. I mean,
yes,
you know.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I work with Aboriginal communities, yes, in Australia, yep, Native American communities, yep, and we can look at other Tibetan,
of course,
Tibetans.
Absolutely. That's right.
And so, you know, I can follow, yes, we've got different karmas arising, mm-hmm, and... you know, you can meet that as we see the Dalai Lama and various people, Martin Luther, have the capacity to meet that from a different place.
Yep.
But, yeah, I get a little stuck there around sort of...
I know. Okay, yeah. This is the wisdom wing and the compassion wing. We're talking here the wisdom wing. We're sort of talking here the work we have to do on ourselves to put ourselves together to whatever degree. It could be even one day's work. It doesn't matter. So that then you can get out there and be of benefit to others. So putting it that way, the final point is the compassion wing. You know, the final point is to get out there and to be of benefit to others in this absolutely unselfconscious way where you just act to be of benefit to others. But again and again, the way that, for example, the Dalai Lama says, but compassion is not enough. You need wisdom. So if I look at my own life back when I was politically active before I was a Buddhist, right, like in the 60s and 70s, and very radical, full-on old lefty, right, trying to bash the world into shape. And completely meaning well, really meaning well. But as Lama Zopa says, meaning well is not enough. You need wisdom. So what I could see was I never, ever factored in the necessity for Robina to know Robina well, for Robina to put herself together and look at her uncontrolled anger and her uncontrolled neurosis and her paranoia and her inability to see things more clearly. I really meant well. I wanted to get out there and make the world a better place. But often it was motivated by this powerful kind of energy of wanting to smash things in another shape, which is fine. But I didn't do enough work on myself. I knew I had to do more of the wisdom wing. So I could say here, right now, as a Buddhist, there's no difference in my wish to want to make the world a better place. But what I'm factoring in now is the necessity for me to know myself more deeply so that when I do act, it's action that will be skillful, that will be beneficial, instead of just shouting and yelling and crossing your fingers that something you say and do might bring a benefit. And the thing is, too, if you look at another point of view, from this point, another way of looking at the necessity to develop the wisdom wing. If we look at it from this point of view we were just discussing, that if I'm overwhelmed by my own neuroses, my own anger, my own hurt, my own jealousy, I mean, in the end, I can do some things to benefit others, but it's going to be pretty limited because my own needs are going to be pretty intense, right? So if I can get rid of my own neuroses and become a really developed person internally, I'm going to have 10 times more energy and more skill and perseverance to be a benefit to others. Because right now with our own neuroses, we can't see past our own nose. So I can even see, for example, when I was politically active, when I was a bit of an old hippie, that was my first bit, then I hated all the straight people, they were the blame. Then I sort of came in sort of kind of radical lefty and Mao Tse-Tung and everything, so all the rich people were to blame. And then I was sort of involved with sort of black thing in England and the black prisoner things and everything, and then it was all the white people to blame. And then I was a feminist, it was all the male people, so I kept changing my groups, you know. You understand what I'm saying? So, I mean, that's okay. Any political activity we can do is compassion. It's incredible. To do something to make the world a better place is amazing. But all this one is saying is the more I can get rid of my own blinkers the more broad I can be in my assessment of the world, the more more clear I can be in the suffering of all the beings, and then I can take a certain group due to my karma. I'm working with people in prison. It happens to be that it just turned up that way, you know. Someone wrote a letter 11 years ago, and now we've got this project. So things take you in different directions in your life, you know. But it could just as easily be the victims of crime. Do you understand my point? But whatever it is that you do, the work that you do to help others, your success at it is dependent upon the work you've done on yourself. That's all the wisdom wing means. So then the Buddhist approach to it is seeing your own neuroses. And it can easily be misinterpreted as just getting caught up and looking at your own navel all day, you know. So the wisdom wing on its own is not enough. But the compassion wing is not enough either, because it's too You know, as the Dalai Lama said one time, when in an interview, he said, when the interviewer said to him, but it seems like there's a really good thing in anger. It makes you act. And he said, I know what you mean, but he said, when you're motivated by compassion, which in Buddhist terms is very sort of not just some wishy-washy feeling, but a very genuine recognition of the suffering of every single sentient being, because they're all caught up in their own neuroses and their own negative karma, right? Then when you're motivated by compassion, he said, you'll never give up. Anger gives up. And I can see even the people I worked with in the political days in the 60s and 70s, they're all fat and middle-aged now, and they couldn't care less. Because anger finishes, you know. When anger goes, you're no longer motivated. Your own needs are overwhelmed again, you know. Do you see what I'm saying? A bit. Yeah. Oh, so you mean you're talking more from the karmic point of view?
Yeah.
The explanation of why the suffering, you mean?
No.
What do you mean? So it's more, so not the approach, I'm just saying. I'm sorry, I wasted my... Okay. But you mean from the explanation of a particular, because of like the Aborigines or something, because of their particular experience and the historical thing? What
yeah,
do you say?
I mean,
no, exactly. I understand. Sure. Okay. Sure. Well, look at that.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
I know.
And then there's, okay, so how do you move out of that trauma as a people or, you know, individually? I mean, yeah, okay, it is.
No, I see what you're saying, yeah.
There's still some
aggression. Oh, the actual. No, exactly. I understand. No, so you talk to only Tibetan. Who've got, let's say, the Buddhist approach in their life, but there they are trying to keep their culture together, trying to keep their music going. Some people who, you know, there's a friend of mine who learned for years how to do all the, who learned as a, learned from the tailors in the monasteries how to do the different dresses of all the different kind of cultural parts of Tibet. So she did all these exhibitions of dolls, you know, of the different, so they try to keep alive their culture. It's true. No, it's true as a group. They continue to function as a Tibetans with their political history and stuff. There's no contradiction. But the difference, of course, for the Buddhists would be they're also looking at the internal one and all understand the view of karma. So this is what is sort of like the inner one for them, you know. But of course, it depends. I mean, for the Aborigine, you wouldn't say it's karma, so they wouldn't say it's karma. They've got their own different way of saying it. So then according to people, isn't it? But the Buddhists would have an explanation of why. You see, the Buddhists would explain that, you know, in a past life, Mary Jones living in, you know, the Australian Aboriginal blah blah, experiencing whatever she's experiencing now, you could look at her external history. And the same goes for a Tibetan. But past life, they might not have been an Aboriginal. This is the whole point. You've got the historical group called Tibetans. But the person who's, you know, half of us who are Tibetan Buddhists now were probably Tibetan in a past life, but now we're called Australian or American. So on one side, there is the external package, the historical cultural thing. But from an internal point of view, a Buddhist would know very well that in past life I was completely a different race. So what, you know, where's it all mean? You know? So there's two things going on here, isn't there? So there's different things to be addressed. You know? I'm not giving you any answers, just talk. Yeah, meaning. Oh, okay. Oh, did you? Oh, right. I was there last year, wasn't I? That's right. Well, thank you. Okay. That's it, exactly. So come and see us. Open when we talk to them. So who else? Is it? Oh, is it? Oh, it's just the Tibetan packaging of this course to enlighten. This Tibetan packaging on this course for developing your wisdom wing and your compassion wing, that's all. And all I've done really in this first one is touch on a few things, but really the main one is touching on the potential, on what the potential is, how you've got this potential to develop your qualities and your capacity to be a benefit to others. So that's really all it is. That's all. Well, that's it. We're done, are we, already? Okay. Yeah, well, 11 years ago, when I was editing the magazine about this organization, the FPMT, the organization, the broader organization of this center and the one in San Francisco, got this letter from this young Mexican guy who was at one of these prisons in Northern California called Pelican Bay, is in one of these top security sections they call security housing units, which are quite common model for prisons now, for permanent lockdown, as they call it, where the inmates are in their cells 23 to 24 hours a day. Because, and especially in California, because of the gang activity, which is so huge, it's just stupendous, you know. Kind of the gang activity, as one of the prisoners said to me, they runs the prisons, you know. It's incredible. And so there's this prison where they're in lockdown all the time, and he was there because he'd slit somebody's throat in some gang war. And anyway, he'd read a book of Lama Yeshe and was moved by the talk of compassion, and so found our address, and I wrote to him eventually. And then as a result of that, we've now got this thing called Liberation Prison Project. We're based in the city, in Oak and Webster, at our centre there, at Tse Ching, which Michelle runs, and I run the prison project. And we have six, seven, eight staff full-time working now. We spend about $30,000 a month. It all comes from donations. We have letters. We get letters mostly. We have a very good kind of database, good system, and we get letters from maybe 600, 700 letters every month from prisoners and from also chaplains. We help chaplains, and we send lots and lots of books to people. We write to people. We've got a couple of hundred, maybe all together around. In Australia, we're based now as well. We're in Spain, Mexico. We've got a couple of hundred volunteer people who write to prisoners. And we have a system where we send, you know, PDF files of the letters to the people. We've got teachers in Italy, teachers all over the place. So our main thing is write to people, keep personal contact. Where we provide them with lots of materials, with study programs, with books. We take care of chaplains. We look after them, who can then look after their, you know, prisoners who might like Buddhism. Basically, that's what we do. We have a bunch of people who go into prisons. Judith's one of our teachers. Katie and Sarah here, they work for us. Where? Who? Oh, Emily too. Emily, yes, she helps prisons as well. That's right. We try to have more and more teachers working for groups in prison as well. So that's what we do, really. And, yeah, that's what we do. Oh, yeah, we do a newsletter every couple of months, yeah. Grab a newsletter. Yeah, sure, grab one. We do one every 2 months, showing what's going on in the prisons. Yep, that's it. Oh, we have a pilgrimage. I should do a commercial for our pilgrimage. We have a couple of pilgrimages a year that I've been running for the last 2 years, but I've got a couple of other people doing them this year, nuns. We go to India and Nepal one time, and then we go to Nepal and Tibet another time in May, and then in November, October. And they're really amazing. We've got little cards for the pilgrimages too. Have we got? No. No cards for the pilgrimages? No, never mind. If you got the newsletter, that'll do. Okay, that's all the commercials. What, darling? Well, over the years, I think in the beginning we were like the devil a bit, like these atheists, you know. I think now, though, we have, you know, like Katie works full-time with chaplains in prisons, and more acceptance among chaplains. We've been going 11 years, so it's taken a while, you know. And there's more and more little Buddhist groups in different, going into prisons in this country now. And so there's more, sort of gradually becoming more acceptance from people and people who are actually supportive. Yeah, more and more so now. It's true. Yeah. So that's all, I think. People, food for thought.
There's a statement there's a practice in Tibetan Buddhism that when you want a teacher to come again, you have to request it 3 times.
Okay.
So please come again. And I thank you for being so kind
Oh, did I do that? Did I? Okay. Sure, Judith. I know, darling. It's been a long time since I've been here. Very happy. Thank you, everybody. All of us together.
Oh.
Judith.
You know, there's also something in Tibetan Buddhism where you never step over the prayers.
There's Judith stepping over all the prayers.
Minefield.
I know, darling. Thank you so much, darling. So we just do a little minute. I want to sing a little miniature prayer to finish. And the prayer just really is a bunch of thoughts, okay? The prayer is just a series of thoughts. And the thoughts in these little prayers, one of them is saying, okay, here we've all been for a couple of hours, as many moments as there have been, is as many thoughts each of us has had. So, and they're like seeds. So may we ripen these seeds. May we nourish these seeds from this moment forward. Remembering you're not the same person that walked in the door, you know, a couple of hours ago. No way. And secondly, the second little prayer, so that these seeds ripen as in the development of our own amazing potential so we can really be of benefit to others. And the second little prayer just makes the aspiration that compassion grow and grow in the hearts of all. And we can just sing these in Tibetan, little nice little tunes. Gewa di nyu du dag lama sangge drugyune Drowa chi kyang malupa Dei sala kupa shog Jang chod sem chog Rinpoche ma ke panam ke gyu chig Kepa nyam pa me pa yang gong ne gong du pel ba sho. That's all, no anymore. Thank you. No more. No, thank you. It's fine. Thank you very much, everybody. Very happy. Thank you, everybody. This kid looks like, tea and cookies.
Homemade cookies. Rare.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and if you just, please come next week.
Do it again.